The Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies presents the Pearl of Great Price Lecture Series, given by Dr. Hugh Nibley. Today's lecture is entitled, The Human Condition.
So far, we've considered this. Remember, there are many precious things, very important, very valuable things that have been removed from the scripture. We say, well, the Pearl of Great Price has replaced them, has restored them. And we talked about first a number of doctrines. First, what the original teaching was, which is well documented, how it was received and how it was wiped out by conventional Judaism, Christianity, and so forth, and the world in general, its rejection. That's well documented, and also its restoration, including the inclination of some people to return to it today. First, we talked about literalism, the idea, are these things real? No, religion is spiritual. We're not dealing with literal things here. That was very important, remember, this, the literal basis. And then, goes from there to the doctrine of the pre-existence, such as in the story of the pearl and so forth. Well, they used to believe that. They don't believe it now, it's condemned, but many are moving in that direction. And then the cosmological element. You've got to bring the real universe into it, into the cosmology into it. And this leads us, of course, to the story of creation. Was it creation out of nothing? Is it ex nihilo? And we said, now, what did they always teach about that? Well, the pre-existence is the council in heaven. They go together, see, pre-existence and creation. We were talking about the council in heaven, and we mentioned the Memphite theology, the Shabako stone, the oldest in the world. And we also talked about, we mentioned briefly, the Enuma Elish. Now, we could add many to them. We could add dozens to them, because they all follow more or less the same pattern. A pattern emerges here, and there are now endless articles on borrowings and influences and origin, who started what, why these are all so different. Does this begin? See, there are all sorts of cults and the like throughout the world, and yet they all have the common themes. So who is borrowing from who, and how did it originate, and so forth? How did it? Yes. And this is a waste of time. But finally, they're beginning to find out that things do fall into patterns. Recently, just recently, it's just come out, in fact, there's a long study by a student who was in this class for three different semesters in the Epoche, the Journal of History of Religion at UCLA, on this subject. He lifted the whole thing, which is the idea, of course. What's it? No, he didn't, of course. He did an awful lot of work. He's done a great job here. But it's about the mystery symbolism and classic recognition drama. See, we talked about, remember, Clementine recognitions? He doesn't mention the Clementine recognitions here, but the recognition drama, the old mysteries, the old method of teaching this stuff was in a dramatic presentation, which centered at all the temples. That's what you start out with, the Shabako stone and so forth. And you think, well, there are countless combinations and countless plots and so forth. That's the joke. You put them all together and you just get one. They all tell the same story. It's a rather complex one, and this is very interesting. He ends his thesis with a quotation from Martin P. Nilsson, who was a professor in Berkeley, Seder professor, a Swede who wrote a vast two-volume work on Greek religion, but he wrote it in the 1920s, and we know a lot today that we didn't know about then. So he could write this then about Orphism, the Orphic rites and the Orphic mysteries, which emerged in the 7th and 8th centuries B.C., where he says, well, it's the concluding sentiment here. Here it is. Orphism, now notice what Nilsson thinks that Orphism was first invented all this, about the 7th, 8th century. Orphism is the combination and crown of all the restless and manifold religious movements of the archaic period, not archaic period at all, the last period, see, after the great collapse. 1000 BC, when the climate shifted and all the ancient sacral kingdoms collapsed at once, and it was a terrible time everywhere. Well, the introductory chapter of the thing called the Approach to the Book of Mormon, we deal with the condition in the time of Lehi, when the old sacral kingship had passed away, and the question arose, who's in charge around here? So you have the rise of the tyrants, like Polycrates and Dionysus and so forth, and you have that is a tyrant, a very capable man who is ruling and who gives a good rule, but he does not have a right to rule either by family descent or by popular choice. He hasn't been chosen and he doesn't have it by, he doesn't inherit his office, he just took it. Usually those men were very capable. I had to be. You had the age of tyrants, and along with that, an age of revolution and everything else. Well, orphism arose out of that. The development of the cosmogony, you see, you're bringing in the cosmos here, in a speculative direction, with the addition of anthropogeny, the creation of man, which laid the principal emphasis on the explanation of the mixture of good and evil, the problem of good and evil. You notice this was all in the Chewbacca stone. It didn't originate first in the 7th, 8th century. The mixture of good and evil in human nature, the legalism in the ritualism of life, the mysticism of cult and doctrine, the development of the other life into concrete visibility, the transformation of the lower world into a place of punishment and adaption rather than eternal hell and so forth, and retribution, the idea of repentance, and that the idea that life is not just a repetition of the present over and over and over again, the cycle, not trapped in the cycle. The belief in the happier lot of the purified and the initiated. See, you have the rites and the ordinances, and they're supposed to provide you with a sort of happiness and can be found. For all these things, parallels, or at least suggestions, can be found in other quarters. These things have been floated around the world forever, and we'll soon see why they were. The greatness of Orphism lies in having combined all this into a system, and in the incontestable originality which made the individual, in his relationship to guilt and retribution, the center of its teaching. Well, for one thing, we still know very little about Orphism, less than anything else. But the point is, these have already been combined into a system. That's what we saw already in the Enumeralish, in the Memphite theology. And the incontestable originality, does that make it original? Which makes it a problem of individual guilt and retribution. Or it keeps telling us, to everyone who does evil so-and-so, to whoever does that and so-and-so. Well, but these decisions are forced on us, not original. I say the Yazidis have been going around all the time. Of course they've been going around. That's all people could think of. We've been unable to think of anything else all these years because the problem never ceases to face us all the time. The pressure is on all the time. The hopeless disproportion, the hopeless imbalance between our capacity and our performance. See, I know I could do a lot better than this. I know I could bumble and stumble and mix my words up and so forth and stray off in all directions. I could do better than that. Why don't I? And so forth. But what we are and what we could be are so different. Because as we're told in, well, John Nichols tells us, we don't use one ten thousandth of our brain power. We never use it. Think of the capacity we have for enjoyment. Think of all the things we're... I lie on my bed and fret when I look up and see all the books on the wall there I have by my bed. Here's an Arabic book I would just love to read, but I don't have time. I can't read anymore. Knock my head off trying to learn to read this stuff, and when I get to it, I can't use it because I'm doing something else. All this stuff's with Egyptian. I don't have any time for that stuff. Well, it's pretty sad, isn't it, that you can't begin to use it. There must be a reason for this, we think. The solution must be found in other times and places because the time is too short here. We can't play a game of baseball in 3 minutes or in a closet. We don't have time enough in 3 minutes, and the closet doesn't give us space enough. And that's the situation we're in here. You see, we're time-bound. We're in a time box. We can't move in any direction. We bump into something. Don't have time for that. Of course, we don't have space for that either because we can't think of everything at once. Just one thing at a time. We must always concentrate. This is what we're condemned to do in this life, is to concentrate always on just one thing at a time. The rest, if you see it at all, makes just sort of a background, side issues and so forth. You're aware of it, of course, but you concentrate on only one object, and you concentrate, as Eccles also says, on the object you choose to. That makes this life a time of probation. That shows what the desire of your heart is. For with the possibility of thinking of a billion things, you prefer to think of one particular thing you've judged yourself in. This is what I wanted among all these things. Well, anyway, we're trapped in this time box and the limited horizon. We have tunnel vision only, because that's all you can see. I can just see here. I can't see any of those other places at once, and that's just too bad. So we feel cheated, and quiet desperation is our lot. The luckiest man who ever lived was Oedipus. Think of the two great plays that have survived from Oedipus. The final chorus of the Oedipus Rex is the... I got to go into trance now. O patres, thebe senoi koi leuset Oedipus. O citizens of Thebes, all you people of Thebes, all your dwellings of Thebes, glorious paternal Thebes. Look, here is your hero Oedipus. Hosta clean enigmat ede kai kratistus enanair. The one man who knew the riddle, the celebrated riddle of the Sphinx, which had gone throughout all the world. Incidentally, you find Sphinx, they have more archaic stuff in the Museum of Thebes than anywhere else. There's Thebes, see? And you go to Thebes, and what do you find in the most archaic version? There's sphinxes on half the vases, though the Sphinx did come from Thebes. And when you go to Thebes in Egypt, which has exactly the same name, what do you find? Sphinxes. Interesting connection. We won't go into it now, but it's very archaic. Well, utis udze lo politon, tais tukais epiblechon. There wasn't a single man anywhere, fellow citizens or anything else, don't politon, who didn't look at his fabulous luck, tais tukais, with envy. Ze lo, our word zeal, envy, jealousy comes from that. Udze lo, we're not without zeal. Utis udze lo, not one person looked without envy. Tais tukais epiblechon. Saw his fabulous good luck. And es hosum cludona symphoras elilitha, cake symphoras. To such a tragic, denos, denes symphoras. Es hosum cludona denes symphoras elilitha. And to this he has come. Now you couldn't imagine a man in a worse condition. He's going out begging, as you know, he's blinded himself. He can't go back, he's cursed, he's under a curse, nobody can take him in under their roof. He's blinded, and here's the greatest man in the world, and look at him now, you see. Looking at which, he says, hosta, so that, phenonton, a canane tain telotion edain, emeron, looking at this final consummation of things, telotion meant his last day, looking, any mortal, you see, Thanonot, anyone who's mortal looking at this condition. That is the Acharith of the Old Testament, you see. Never judge a thing until the Acharith, until the final solution, until the final end. The Telotion, Himeron, the last day. So any mortal looking at this, and then comes the moral, me then obidze prin an kermatubeu parese. May then Algenon Pathon. Don't judge any man fortunate until he has finally gone around. This isn't always translated, which is wrongly, has reached the terminal of his life. The word is terma, but the terma is the place, is the turning place in the race where you're supposed to be wrecked. And if you get around that safely, you're all right. In the Roman races, there were the three meta at Olympia. That was the tomb of Pelops. And the angry ghost always demands a sacrifice. So they would have the horse races, and the chariot was supposed to smash up at the Taraxippus, they call that the Taraxippus, where the horses were terrified by the ghost, and then the human sacrifice had been provided. But one of the chariots was supposed to smash up there. And until you parese, I mean, until he was gone around the terma, see, the terma is the same as a trophy. That's the place where you turn back. And you bring a trophy back from where you have been. The last place you reach is the place where you've turned, and you bring the trophy back to show that you've been there. Well, anyway, tot parese me then algenon pathon, without having suffered any such horrible ill, algenon is a sickness, everything bad. Well, that's the moral. Don't call any man blessed, because this can happen to the luckiest person who ever lived. But then comes the second play, the great plague. Well, really, one play is missing. The final play is Oedipus in Colonus, which is the greatest play of Sophocles. That there is still a possibility, there is still a hope. Surprise, surprise, and it goes back in the ancient ordinances and so forth. And it takes us through that. We go through the initiation of the temple and all that sort of thing. And that play has an end too. Alapopao to mave epipleo threnonagere. Put an end to all mourning now, forget all that. This has all been a misunderstanding, if any. Pantosgar eche tada kiros. All things are in the hands of God. Everything has been provided for. There is a plan. Your business is to find out what it is. But instead of mourning about it, try to find out that, because there must be a meaning to this. So as he says, Pantosgar eche tada kiros. Well, now, why not examine, then, the implications of this strange situation arrangement? We're on the stage and we need the scenario, yeah.
What was the play called?
That's the Oedipus in Colonus, the city of Colonus. That's where he returned to the place of his birth. He was born there originally, and he goes back and he comes to the sacred place, and they won't let him in because he's cursed and so forth. But then Theseus comes from Athens and gives him the ordinances. His daughters perform the washings and anointings and so forth, and he goes through the... And when he disappears, finally Theseus says, I can't tell you what happens after this. You come up the veil and so forth. But get this, be happy about this, there is hope. Well, then that's Oedipus, the one who limps. See, we limp through life. Robert Graves wrote a lot of that, so that we had to. Well, there are three times confront us. There are three possibilities, three major plots, eight major plots, because three times, past, present, and future. There are three lives to consider. Is there a past, present, and future? This gives us these eight possibilities of the I Ching. If you read Friedrich Porth's book on the subject, the I Ching, you know something about that. Well, this is what the plots are then. We say this is the past, namely pre-existence, and this is the present, this life, and of course then we have the future life. And we'll say they're either dark or light. I use D for dark and L for light. This is the common one. So the past, the pre-existence, is dark. We know nothing about it. It's mysterious and it's lost. Plot number one, this is the commonest plot, actually. There are eight possibilities, and there are philosophies based on each one. World philosophies, important philosophies, and religions based on each one. But this life, there's a little fun in it, so it's light. But what comes after is darkness. That's the thing that Oswy wanted to get out. Let's put King Oswy down here. The story of the conversion of King Oswy, the first English king to accept Christian missionaries, is the story of that. They're having the banquet in the hall, and it's light and bright, and they're celebrating, and at either end of the hall, of the great hall, and these Kiala, Hornus Nabereth, those are the horns of the hall, is open to let the smoke out of them. And a swallow comes in, sparrow, no, it's a swallow comes in, and is completely dazzled and frightened by the light, and flies around a while, makes itself at home, and then flies out again. And Oswy sees it, and he says, well, that's our life. We come out of this great darkness, we see a little moment of light, and then we fly out again. And he says to the Christian missionaries, if you can give me anything better than that, I'll listen to you. So he does, because that's what Christianity promises, something better hereafter, but nothing before. Well, so Oswy, this is the standard scenario. It's really an evasion, actually. We accept this life because we have to. We can't deny it. But for the rest, we just deny them. That's what most people do. Well, let's put Oswy here, for that matter. The conversion of King Oswy. The most famous student song in the world. Students all know this one. Gaudium Sigitur. This is a philosophy. It was forbidden by the church. Everybody sang it morning, noon, and night. The most famous student song. Gaudium Sigitur. Juvenis dum sumus. Well, let's enjoy ourselves while we can, while we're still young. Post jucundum juventutum, post molestum senectutum, nos habebitumus. After joyful youth, after miserable old age, nos habebitumus. The earth is going to have us. And that's all there will be to it. Which is an extension, really, of the fifth ode of Catullus, the most romantic, most lyrical of all the Roman poets, is Catullus. The famous Vivamus mea lesbia ad quememus. Let's live, lesbia, and love. Then it goes, Rumores qua sanum severiorum, unius habemus, omnes unius habemus asim. Live and love my lesbia, that's his lady friend. Let's all the rumors, all the traditions, all the possibilities, let's just forget them. Omnes semi severiorum. Now this person has inspiration, thank you very much. This is your... three cheers for you. Sanus severiorum, they're the severe seniors and so forth, but they're the rumors and traditions of the past. Omnes, all of them, unius pro habemus, istimemus asum. Let's esteem them as worth one penny, perhaps a penny, but forget all that. Why? Because soles accedere et redire possunt. The sun goes down and the sun comes up. The suns can set and the suns can rise again. But nobis cum semel occidit brevis lux. But once our brief light has gone down, has gone out, what happens after that? Nox est perpetua una dormiende. there's nothing but one long perpetual night of sleep. So let's, and then he goes on, and what's the solution? Da mihi miliabasa, deign decentum, deign decentum, de miliabasa, give me 1,000 kisses, then give me 100 more, then give me 1,000, we'll just go wild in love. We'll just make sex and forget about everything else, that's the idea. Well, that's an escape, that's the escape from it, because there's nothing else. As remember, as Alma says, in the time of Korihor, when the man died, that's the end thereof. Therefore, the people raised their heads and decided they could do anything they wanted to do. But as far as the actual philosophers are concerned, these are very important schools of philosophy. The Epicureans, that was their teaching. Yeah, the teachings of Epicurus. And the Philosophica, the inventor of atoms, the man who started the whole of atomic physics, and it was a good sound theory he had, was Democritus. And they called him the laughing philosopher because it's just atoms that make things and nothing else, so there's nothing to worry about, and so you just laugh. Just laugh it off and enjoy yourself. Well, as Pascal said, it was a hollow laugh. It was the hollow laugh of the libertine. Democritus. Who was the first? Who was the atomist? And I say was called the laughing philosopher because there was nothing to worry about here. And we... it's Epicurean. If you're an Epicurean, just enjoy what you can get here and don't worry about anything else. That is the famous nil admirari ode of Horace. Don't get involved in anything, don't get interested in it, just relax. And he says, you come to me and you'll find me a porcus aegri Epicuri. You'll find me just a comfortable pig from the sty of Epicurus, just enjoying things as they go. Don't let these things worry you, don't let anything worry you. That's the famous nil admirari, and that nil admirari is a slogan, you see, as far as that goes. And we have our light time here. Shakespeare uses a lot of this, you know, our revels now are ended, these are actors, as I foretold you, are spirits and have melted into air, into thin air, and like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all that it inherit, beautiful show now, shall dissolve, and like this unsubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are the stuff that dreams are made in, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. So he says, it was pleasant while the show lasted, but it was only a show. It came out of nothing, it was just imagination, and it will fade into nothing. So enjoy it while you can, and that's all there is. See, at base, it's quite sad, isn't it? Houseman, A.E. Houseman, all his poems are on that subject. With a rue my heart is laden for many a light heart lad, for many a rose-lip maiden, for many a friend I had, for many a rose-lip maiden and many a light heart lad. My streams too wide for leaping, the light heart youths are laid, the light heart lads are laid. The rose-lipped maids are sleeping in fields where roses fade. That's it, you see. It's, as I say, it's sad. And so, with Omar, you say, take the cash and let the credit go, and so forth. Some for this life, and some for the paradise to come. Take the credit. Some for this life, and some yearn for the paradise to come. Oh, take the cash and let the credit go. Don't heed the rumble, nor heed the rumble of a distant drum, you see. The drum, the bad time's coming, the drum's ahead, you know, doom, forget it. Don't pay any attention to it. If you want to survive, you better. But anyway, you don't. Because some for the pleasures of this life, that's fine, and some long for the paradise to come, but you take the cash, take what you can get now and let the credit go. And what you do is get lost in wine. Of course, I never cared for anything but wine. Come, fill the cup. And in the fire of spring, your winter garment of repentance. Forget about repentance. The bird of time has but a little way to flutter, and the bird is on the wing. We sighted that gloomy one, you know, oh, make haste. The stars are setting, and the caravan makes for the dawn of nothing. Oh, make haste. Well, this is the light, dark, light philosophy, and it's a common one of the human. It's the seven ages. It's the quiet desperation. You seem to be all right, getting along as you can. Remember Richard Corey in the Spoon River Anthology, and one fine summer's night, went home and put a bullet through his head. Just like Oedipus, everybody thought he was the most successful man in town, and everybody envied him and so forth. But Richard Corey, one fine summer's night, no explanation, went home and put a bullet through his head. The New England doctors, we all live as we're told in Walden, we all live lives of quiet desperation. So, oh, we can get away with it by distractions. We can perhaps distract ourselves from it. And of course, this is the furious concern today with sports, with competition, with success, with drugs. See, that's all escape. It's all distraction. Unwilling to face this horrible thing. It's too much to look at, to look at nothing, you know. Quoting Claudio saying, remember, the weariest and most loathed earthly life that age, ache, penury, and imprisonment can lay on nature is a paradise to what we fear of death. Well, and so we try to anticipate it with crusades and competitions and wars. We try to anticipate a terrible end, use Hitler's expression, a terrible continued existence, an intolerable existence with a terrible end. Lieber ein schreckliches Ende, als ein Schrecken ohne Ende. We'll go on in this condition until we have an answer, we're not satisfied. We've got to win or lose. Let's get it over with. We get a lot of that today, you know. And Tao and Zen, those religions, they anticipate annihilation by saying, don't expect anything, don't take anything seriously, and then you won't be disappointed. And our scenario for today, of course, is the car and the gun that sum everything up, you know, and the explosion. The mandatory explosion, I would say. And the Book of Mormon, of course, is the tract for our times where it deals with that thing exactly. I was thinking, coming up the hill, you might paraphrase the prologue to Romeo and Juliet. Two families both alike in dignity and fair Verona where we lay our scene. What human beings do, you could paraphrase it to two nations both alike. This is the theme of the Book of Mormon and the present world to which the Book of Mormon is addressed. Two nations both alike in dignity, on this fair planet where we lay our scene, from ancient grudge break to new mutiny, where human blood makes human hands unclean. See? From out the fatal loins of these two foes, a pair of star-crossed lovers take their life, the new generation, you see, whose misadventures, piteous overthrows, seal with the children's blood the parents' strife. They have to pay for the parents' grudges and the wars and the armaments and all that sort of thing. The fearful passage of their death-marked love and the extremity of their parents' rage, but the children's death not could remove. They would only settle their scores after everybody had been killed, actually, and that's what happened, as you know, in Romeo and Juliet. The younger generation just gets wiped out, and the elders are still left to build monuments to them and utter platitudes in the last scene there. And the extremity of their parents' rage, which but their children's death not could assuage, is now the two-hour traffic of our stage, and so forth. So, well, that's one. Now, we have another philosophy, which is dark. Dark, that's the cheerful one, dark. Is it dark all the way? Well, of course it is. A wicked person, Macbeth's famous, we all know, out brief candle, life's but a walking shadow. A poor actor that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It's a tale told by an idiot, signifying, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. He came out of hell, he's in hell, and he's going back to hell. That's Macbeth as far as we can see it. But Hamlet, too, how weary, flat, stale, and unprofitable are all the usage of this world. Fie on it, fie. It is an unweeded garden that grows to seed. Things rank and gross possess it merely, and so forth. So he asked himself, well, why shouldn't I bump myself off? Look, what you have to put up with this world, remember? The proud men's contumely, the pangs of despised love, the spurns, the patient merit, from the unworthy take, the insolence of office, the law's delays. Everything we have to put up here is a lot of nonsense, and it's horrible. He says there's no escape for it. Unless, he says, we could make an end to it. Who would grunt and sweat under a weary load when he might his own quietus make with a dagger? Just end it all right there. But he says, no, what comes after may be even worse. There, he says, is the respect that makes calamity of so long life. We're willing to hang on because it might even be worse. Who can tell after this, you know, after we've left when this life, the bourne from which no traveler returns. Well, this will give us pause to dream, to sleep, perhaps to dream. Ah, there's the rub, for in that sleep of death, what dreams might come when we have shuffled off this mortal coin and say that are pretty terrible. And so we put up with it, he says. We wouldn't put, but it was the dread, as he says, but it's all the dread of something after death that makes us positive. and maybe even worse after. So, well, that's not very, very inconsolable. You notice all bad, 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 as far as he's concerned. Well, is this part of a religion? Yes, it is. And a philosophy, it's the Stoicism. These are the Stoics. And, well, we say Stoic. This is the Stoic religion, and this is what they're proud of. This is religion of defiance, Invictus, out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I think, whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. let me see, in the fell clutch of sorghum stench, it's really circumstance, you see, of sorghum stench, I have not winced or cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody but unbowed. Well, this is the famous Invictus, you know. Well, if you want to enjoy that sort of thing, you're welcome. But it is the heroic position. No, it's the heroic. And remember, ancestors, the religion of the sagas, with the Ragnarok and Gedda Demerung and all that stuff, they're winding down to sure destruction, and the gods themselves who've got to look forward only to the monsters of disarray and... The second law of thermodynamics is going to run down and be destroyed, the Fenris wolf, these things that signify them. So it is the heroic or epic position. So this is what you get in Homer, where it says, polos diphimus psychas aed proiapsum. There you are, you see. Dautusta heloria tefka gnesim oionoiti didaita. Dio said to Laetavula, what happened to all these heroes? They were caught like rats in a trap. He said, there was no way of escaping. They'd been there 10 years, and as the great epic begins, what's happening? There is dysentery in the camp, and everybody's dying off. Well, what a romantic war, you see. Dysentery in the camp, and everybody's dying. Fame caie thamonto, and the flames, are funeral flames burning all over the camp all day long. The stink is terrible, and so forth. And he says, Proiops, and these heroes were set down and became bait for the birds and food for the dogs. That's it. At Nora, all you know, it's a feast for the for the birds. All you know, it's a diet and bait for the dogs. Well, so Homer, this is your heroic position, isn't it? The consolation that Achilles gives, the only consolation to a hero whom he is about to wipe out, is Alaphilos Thanakaisu, Kathanakai Patroclus. And that is a very real philosophy of the military, isn't it? But friend, I'm afraid you've got to be killed too, but don't worry about it. T.A. Olafuriae Hutus, what's all this rumpus about? What are you complaining about? Kathonikai Patroclus, Patroclus died, and he was a much better man than you, so what are you complaining about? And this was the comfort you would take in this sort of thing. So it's your heroic religion, Patroclus and so forth. And Dover Beach, we all know about Dover Beach. Ah, love, let us be true to one another. Remember what that is? For the world which seemed to be, I've got you out of down here, to lie before us like a land of dreams. I haven't looked at Dover Beach. It's a great favorite with English departments, as you know. So very, very various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy nor love, nor light, nor certainty, nor peace, nor help for pain. This world has nothing to offer, he says. And we are here, listen to me, we are here as on a darkling plain, swept by confused alarms of struggle and fight, where ignorant armies clash by night. That's the world we live in, you see, we're here, he says, as on a darkling plain, swept by confused alarms of struggle and fight. Oh, what a thing. No, he said, this. They thought it was such a wonderful world, this world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams. Well, the gospel offers us, this is the world that came from the hand of God and so forth. It's a great place. So varied, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. Who's to blame for that? So that's not a very good, very cheerful doctrine, is it? But it was held by a large part of the human race who didn't want to give in to this. They felt it was unworthy. See, the Stoics is unworthy of the pride of man. It's proud to be just play around and get sodden and drunk and lie around and enjoy yourself as much as you can. So we have the light, dark, light here. So light, dark, light. This is the most important of all religiously, because this is the one that's behind all the cults, all the dramas, and this is behind Pythagoras. This is the Hermetic doctrine. That means the doctrine that came back down from Thoth, from Hermes, from the Egyptians in the beginning of the world. This has been handed down unbroken, and it is the Hermetic tradition from Hermes. Hermetic, which of course is shared by Pythagoras,
most important of all, Amoras, and of course Plato. There's your Plato, and you go down the list.
The apocalyptic. It's the Gnostic. All the Gnostics are Neoplatonists.
They wouldn't take it literally. See, they said, well, it's all just spiritual anyway, and
you would have. Who else would you have besides them? Well, I've got down here the apocalyptic, the mystic, the pearl belongs to this. You notice the pearl, he comes out of the light, he's in this dark and corrupt world, and then he goes back to the light again. And that's what you have in Moses. Moses, look at Moses, remember? He's with the Father in the beginning, then he comes down to be tempted, then he goes back again. And the book of Abraham, he gives us an account of the council in heaven. Abraham, thou art one of them, many great and noble ones, and he was one of them. And then he comes down here and suffers the 10 trials of Abraham. He lives his life in tribulation, doesn't even have a grave where he can bury himself, has to rent it from the Hittites, And so, the same thing, and as the Lord told his apostles, in this world ye shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. If these others are reliable, then don't worry about this one too much. As there is a hymn in the Thanksgiving hymns of the Dead Sea Scrolls that says, if you knew what you were before, or could see what you're to be hereafter, then you wouldn't worry about anything. Nothing could discourage you at all. In the battle, as a matter of fact, in the battle fragment, it talks, not a fragment, that's complete. In the Milchama, the battle scroll, that tells us that when Israel is defeated in battle, don't be discouraged, just remember what was before and what comes after. This won't last forever. So this is the one that carries on, as we find in the Pearl, and in the New Testament, we shall find tribulation. But why the tribulation here? Well, let's have another one then. Again, dark. Now we get standard Christianity and Judaism. Dark, they don't believe in a pre-existence, and light and like. You have eight possible combinations, you'll see here, and these are the first four. These are the most important, or are they at all? Well, this is standard Christianity and Judaism, dark, light, and like. The defective scenario, it lacks in protology, and it makes it a very unbalanced sort of scenario. The problem of evil becomes a mystery. If you're suddenly out of nothing, you come into something. And, of course, St. Augustine is your best guide here. That is what made him the kingpin of Christian theology, of all sects. He gives us such things as we come into the world, predestinatio, which became the thing, you see, with the Calvinists and so forth. You come here. God has already decided whether you will be damned or whether you will be blessed. You're predestinatio ad damnationem or predestinatio ad salvationem. You are predestined either for salvation or damnation. There's nothing you can do about it. God has taken care of that. That's because they left this particular play or this particular scene out. I say it's defective. The problem of evil is insoluble. They never could solve it. That's why so many of them turned Gnostics and so forth. That's why Augustine, Manichaeans belong in here. Augustine, for the nine best years of his life, says, was a Manichaean, because they accepted this, and he wouldn't accept this later on, because the people at the school in Rome and so forth, before he joined the church, laughed at such things. They were not philosophically or scientifically sound, a pre-existent or a post-existent, so he wouldn't accept it. But he talks about contemptio mundi, the contempt of the world, but this world here wouldn't take too much light here, would you? I didn't say dark light, did I? It should be dark light. Oh, that's what it is. As you know, and this world, Augustine said, is a mass of perditionis, is nothing but a festering mass of corruption. That's all it is. And the Gnostics believe that very firmly. It's very important, you see. And what could you do about that? There's nothing you could do about that, he said, unless God has done it already for you. No plan or anything like that. Ficisti nos et te, et inquietus cor nostrum, donec requiescat in te. He says, you have made us, some of us, to turn to you, and our heart is restless until we return to you. And that's a good doctrine, too, as far as that goes. But for the rest, and this takes up the Middle Ages, Dante, the same thing, where Beatrice says, she can't be damned because she wasn't made that way. Io son fatta di Dio, sua mercitale, che la vostra miseria non mi tange. Your suffering can't touch me, ne fiamma desto incendio non mi sale. And the flames of this hell can't touch me at all because God made me that way, and that's all there is to it. You start right out of nothing. You see, it's this ex nihilo, out of nothing. If you're made that way, then what you come into, that's a dark world for a lot of people, and it's a time of, you can't even call it testing, because the test is already decided. It's already, you're, as this, the word is St. Augustine's own word, is predestined, predestinatio, predestination to damnation or to, yes.
What would be the purpose of coming here or being here?
Well, these are the four questions that St. Augustine asks, and that his biographers say he never succeeded in answering. The problems of evil, the problems of damnation of infants, for example. He says, why should infants be damned just because they haven't heard the gospel and die before they have a chance to be baptized? That doesn't seem fair to him at all, but he says, well, he has a solution for it, a rhetorical solution. Remember, he's a great rhetorician. He says, it is a light damnation. It's especially light damnation, which of course reminds me of Bottom in the Midsummer Night's Dream. I will roar as gently as any sucking dove. You see, he won't frighten the ladies, he'll be a roaring lion, but he'll roar gently and softly. And so St. Augustine actually says, yes, there'll be a damnation, a real damnation, an eternal damnation, a hell damnation, but it will be a light and easy damnation. You figure that one out. That, you see, they got themselves into these logical binds and so forth. Well, now, what other things remain here? Well, now we have dark, light, and light. That's what King Oswy wanted, you know. Dark, light, and light. That's the thing he wanted. Once the bird flies into the bright place, he doesn't fly out into the darkness, he flies into out into the light, and that's why he was willing to accept it. And this is what the monastic movement intended to do. We have the writings of St. Anthony, who founded the movement, Anthony and Pacomius, who started the movement in the 4th century. The corruption of the world was so great, he lived in Alexandria, and the Christian world was so utterly vile as far as that goes. The only way you could go was to go to the desert and live by yourself, and then you could form communities, but it was to live the life of angels. Life of angels. So that's making this world a happy place. It's true you come out of the darkness, but by rejecting this world entirely, by contempt for this world, it's a Stoic sort of thing, by contempt for this world, you won't suffer from it, and you get out and live by yourself and spend all your time contemplating God, and so you live in the light here, looking forward, of course, to the light hereafter. This life of angels is a hard one, and they had a hard time making it work, as you know. There are quite a few catches in it. And, of course, we have more literature on that, perhaps, than anything else. At least half the Coptic literature is the trouble these people had living in the desert. Interesting chapter in Gibbon is written about the monastic movement, how they started out. See, the world went so bad after it became completely Christian in the 4th century that they said, well, this isn't the way the apostles lived, this isn't the way the old church lived. The only way I can do is to go out and live by myself. People do that around here all the time. They go out to Baker, and I have all sorts of splinter groups and cultists and so forth that think they can go out and live united and so forth. But it doesn't work very well. It's sad. Of course, we have some marvelous accounts of this. The psychological troubles these people had, they immediately started having hallucinations and so forth, but they weren't happy hallucinations. The famous St. Anthony, as you know, what are the pictures you see of St. Anthony, the Flemish artist or anything else? Is St. Anthony being tempted by the devils? He's surrounded by all sorts of fiends and evil spirits. He's out in the desert alone, and all he does is get temptation. These awful thoughts come to him all the time. He doesn't escape a thing. So you see the picture of St. Anthony in his torments. That's no fun again. Well, then there is light, dark, dark. Do we have that? No, we don't. We might as well put that on here. Six, light, dark, dark. Well, this is an absurdity, of course. If you believe that you lived in a glorious life before you came here, this one is a bad one, and the next a bad one, that doesn't make sense at all. The intimations of immortality without pre-existence, you know. Light, dark, dark. Well, the intimation of immortality, you know the famous poem of Wordsworth, don't you? That everybody's supposed to learn. Our life is but a sleep and a forgetting, the soul that comes, the soul that something with it. Our life's star hath elsewhere its setting and cometh from afar. Yes, that's right. Our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting, the soul that rises with it. Our life star has elsewhere its setting and cometh from afar, not in entire forgetfulness, nor entire nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory do we come from God, which is our home. Then earth lies about us in our infancy, the prison walls close around the broad, of the growing boy, but he beholds the light and whence it flows and sees it in his joy. And then the youth who travels further from the east, who daily further from the east must travel. He's getting further. Notice you're having the four ages of man here. First the child with heaven lying about him. Then the boy, the light begins to fade already. The prison walls begin to close, but still he sees the light. And then the youth is going ever farther and farther away from the east, but he still has some light to go with him. And it says he is splendidly attended, and on his journey by vision splendid is attended. And at length the man perceives the light of day, it fade away. The man perceives it fade away and die away and fade into the light of common day. And where do we go after that? That's the interesting thing. You see, we don't go anywhere. That's the point. He's not really talking about Wordsworth, isn't really talking about the pre-existence. The English department has always been very insistent on that, as you know, because that's true. He doesn't take it literally. He was a romantic poet. And the romantic poets are trying to escape from an evil world. They didn't like the Industrial Revolution. As Wordsworth himself says, the world is too much with it. Late and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. Little we see in nature that is ours, the sea that bears its bosom to the moons, the wind that will be howling at all hours and hours, gathered like sleeping flowers. These see we see not. Great God, I'd rather be a pagan. Now, what's his alternative to this? I'd rather be a pagan suffering by a creed outworn. That's the romantic movement, go back to paganism and so forth. Well, no, the romantic period of a Greece that never really existed. It's like our own Currier and Ives, Rockwell American Society that never was. I should remember, I was there. But they go back to that. Schiller in the Gutter Grecian Land says, Schönelato bist du care vita, oldest getter alter der Natur. Come back again, thou beautiful land, a glorious age, glorious, gentle, lovely age of nature. The Greeks lived in that nature. And of course the Romantic poets try to do that. But Romanticism escape, you see, it's escape. They don't accept it on a religious basis at all, and neither does Wordsworth here. So how far does he agree with these four ages of man? Now the seven ages of man is also, which does that belong to? I think that belongs to this, the seven ages, because Shakespeare makes mock of all seven, doesn't he? And his follows Solon. Solon, probably a friend of Lehi's, who had leave Athens in 600 BC after giving them the first democratic constitution. He wrote a poem on the seven ages of man and the same thing, and it's all downhill as far as that goes. As we get the final thing, the last event in this event. Last scene of this eventful history is second childishness and mere oblivion. Sans eyes, sans teeth, sans taste, sans everything. That's the end of the story. Well, not very happy. But you notice these are the great religious ones, these fourth. Well, we got another one here. We have another yet. Light, light and dark. But again, you see, if you believed in the pre-existence and this was a happy life, that's an absurdity. I don't think there's any religion that preaches that you had a... I don't know. Some of the Indians might preach that you came from a happy home and you're here. They had to see it that way, and they enjoyed their life with the tribe and so forth, but now they've been utterly wiped out, you see. Their chances have gone, but that's forced on them by circumstances here, but you wouldn't build a religion around that. See, that was the Sundance religion. They were trying to restore it, trying to beat that, trying to turn the tide. In 1906, remember, when the Sioux Indians revived the Sundance and it electrified all the tribes everywhere. Well, then we find the most optimistic of all, which is light, like life, which is ours. And I didn't bring my Book of Mormon. Yeah. Hey, it's introduction. And we get that in the Book of Moses here. And, well, it's the Gospel, of course, just briefly here. And you get it in 4th Nephi, where they live after the manner of happiness, and Nephi says, we did live after the manner of happiness. Well, that's happy all the time, and you're supposed to be that, and in our Pearl of Great Price is the best expression of it in the Book of Moses in the 5th chapter here, yes, the 9th to 12th verses, and that will be it. Is it possible to have them all? Yes, they say so, in spite of their sorrows and so forth. And Eve was happy about it. And Eve, his wife, heard these things and was glad. Oh, and in that day Adam blessed God. I mean, he's absolutely, and was filled and began to prophesy. It's not, he thought it was bad and it turned out it wasn't. And as thou hast fallen, thou mayest be redeemed, and all mankind, even as many as will. And in that day Adam blessed God and was filled and began to prophesy concerning all the families of the earth, saying, blessed be the name of God, for because of my transgression my eyes are open, and in this life I shall have joy, and again in the flesh I shall see God. And Eve his wife heard all these things and was glad, saying, were it not for our transgression, we never should have had seed, never should have known good and evil, and the joy of our redemption, and the eternal life which God giveth unto all the obedient. And Adam and Eve blessed the name of God, and they made all these things known unto their sons and daughters. It turned out they were to learn while they were still here that they were perfectly free to enjoy themselves. They'd been happy before they came here, they enjoyed themselves, and they have nothing but happiness to look forward to. As many as will, if you're willing to be obedient. So we do have the gospel, which is all light. The other extreme from this